As you walk up the gently sloping grassy hill, dotted with clumps of lime, oak and willow trees, you quickly realise the building has seen better days. The brick walls have crumbled and there are gaping holes where the windows used to be. It's still an impressive sight. It can be seen for miles around as it looms over the valley below, and despite its state of disrepair, you can still form a pretty good idea of what this Tudor manor farmhouse once looked like. These are the ruins of Hardwick Hall, and it was here that one of Elizabethan Britain's most powerful women was born. I'm Alison Steadman, and this is 125 Treasures, a podcast from the National Trust. Episode 5, The Women in the Hallway.
Hi, my name's Elena Williams. I'm the Senior Collections and House Officer at Hardwick Hall. We refer to the lady as Bess of Hardwick, but she was actually born Elizabeth Hardwick. One of the many questions we get asked is, oh, when was Elizabeth born? When was Bess born? Unfortunately, we can't answer that because her birth wasn't recorded. But we do know she was born here on the site of the old hall.
We may not know her exact date of birth, but it's generally agreed to have been around 1527. In an age when men dominated society, Bess would go on to own vast amounts of land and a fortune rivalled only by royalty. She also collected and commissioned some of Britain's, and now the National Trust's, most precious works of art and textiles. A remarkable rise for a woman from a relatively modest background.
Bess of Hardwick was born in the reign of Henry VIII.
This is Mary Lovell, who wrote the biography Bess of Hardwick, First Lady of Chatsworth.
She was the daughter of farming gentlefolk, I suppose, but no great money. I mean, she came from reasonably humble background, but she was raised as a gentlewoman. Her father died when she was a babe in arms. She never knew her father. And I think she always remembered all her life the struggle that her mother had to raise five children with very little income. Bess had only a rudimentary education, which was common for girls at that time, but she grew up very eager to learn and very eager to get on in life.
By the age of 12, Bess had already left home to work at Codner Castle, 12 miles south of Hardwick.
She's there as a gentlewoman or an upper servant for the family. And this lifestyle, going to other households, was considered a suitable education for the Tudor gentry.
But even as she toiled away in the service of others, Bess knew that marriage was the best way for a woman to gain financial security and social status.
Well, the first of Bess's four famous marriages was when she was 15 and she was married to the teenage son of a neighbour.
Robert Barlow, who is himself from a Derbyshire family, perhaps a bit more prosperous than the Hardwicks, who were but minor gentry.
But she was actually widowed within a year before the marriage was consummated. But this marriage provided Bess with a small widow's dower, which would have allowed her to live a quiet and respectable life if she had not looked higher than that.
A widow's dower was a legal provision which entitled a widow to a portion of her husband's estate if he died without a will. But Bess had to fight to get it, as Robert Barlow's family initially refused to hand over the third of the estate she was due. So, at the age of around 16, she took them to court, an early indication of her extraordinary determination. And though the case took years to settle, eventually she won.
And then we lose track of her for a while, and she re-emerges in the 1540s, perhaps working with the Marchioness of Dorset, who is mother to Lady Jane Grey.
Lady Jane Grey was the great-granddaughter of King Henry VII, who later became the Nine Days Queen, the shortest reigning monarch in British history. The Dorset family were extremely wealthy and owned a number of houses.
One of the family's properties was in Leicestershire, Bradgate Manor, and it's at that family home that she married Sir William Cavendish in the chapel there. And this is where we next see Bess of Hardwick.
Her second marriage, when she was 19, was a very different matter. It was to a man who was twice her age, a very important and successful man at Henry VIII's court. He was ambitious, and so was Bess. The marriage was a happy one, and they were a popular couple with important friends.
They have 8 children, 6 of whom survive beyond infancy, which is quite remarkable for that period of time.
Marriage to Sir William meant that Bess not only now had financial security, she had also advanced her social position.
I would say she's on the outer circle of the royal household. Sir William Cavendish is a prominent statesman. He has earned a lot of wealth. He's probably what you would refer to as one of the new men of the Tudor age.
Over the next few years, Bess and William Cavendish became a great team. Bess running the household, assisting William with his business interests, keeping his books and accounting. Together, they amassed a huge fortune. And with that money, in 1549, they bought the jewel in their property crown, Chatsworth Estate.
Obviously, now we know Chatsworth as one of the great country houses of the country. But then it was just a small estate in the middle of Derbyshire.
Chatsworth has been passed down through 16 generations of Bess's family and is still lived in by her descendants today, the Duke and Duchess of Devonshire. So now it seemed Bess was on the way to securing the life and status she dreamt of. But once again, tragedy struck.
Bess was only 29 when Sir William suddenly died, of quite natural causes. I think he had a burst ulcer, probably, leaving her with 6 children under the age of 10 and 2 teenage stepdaughters. But more than that, he left her with a massive debt. It was £6,000 in those days, but that equates today in spending power to millions. And she had, of course, no way of repaying that debt.
To make matters worse for Bess, Queen Mary, Bloody Mary as she was known, had just come to the throne. Mary was short on money, and looking for a way to help fund her husband, King Philip of Spain's Spanish wars.
Chatsworth seemed to her to be a good way of getting in sudden £6,000. So she asked her financiers to raise new legislation in the House of Parliament so that they could forcibly take Chatsworth and sell it, because Bess and her husband had put every penny that they had earned over the last 10 years into Chatsworth. This would have meant Bess and her children were penniless and homeless.
But Bess was nothing if not a fighter.
This was a big crisis in Bess's life, and I think it showed really what she was made of. She decided she was going to fight the Queen, and I think that was an amazing thing for anyone to do. So you wonder, you know, how on earth would she do this? Well, she did it by what we call today networking. She and her husband had made a lot of important friends at court. Many of them were parliamentarians, and Bess contacted them all by letter. This was highly improper behaviour in a new widow in those days. But she persuaded them all to vote down the legislation when the bill came up to Parliament. Didn't make her very popular with Queen Mary, of course, but what it meant was Chatsworth could not now be sold over Bess's head. The debt still remained. Bess still owed it. And somehow she had to find a way to repay it.
And around this time, Bess's finances were given a boost when she married again.
Bess's third husband, Sir William St. Low, was a favourite courtier of Queen Elizabeth, who came to the throne after Bloody Mary died. Sir William was a tall, strong, handsome military man, and he was in charge of the Queen's security, and he fell madly in love with Bess.
He does have a couple of roles. He's captain of the guard, and we see William portrayed in one of Elizabeth I's coronation paintings, and it's at this point that Elizabeth I invites Bess to be a lady of her privy chamber.
This appointment placed Bess at the very heart of the royal court as a personal attendant and companion of the Queen.
This couple lived at the court, really, and for 5 years it was a truly romantic and a happy relationship. Bess loved to ride and to dance, and she was thoroughly spoiled by this husband who was besotted with her. And then Sir William died, quite suddenly.
And the circumstances of his death were very suspicious, to say the least.
Almost certainly poisoned by his younger brother, who was concerned that this marriage was so happy that Sir William might leave everything to Bess.
There was a rift in his family about Bess and how much control she had and how they worked together in running the estate, so they were concerned she had too much influence.
So while Bess was away visiting Chatsworth, he went to stay with William, and the next thing is William died. I might say that the younger brother had a history of poisoning, but anyway, there was insufficient evidence to convict him.
Sir William died in 1565, and without a male heir.
Sir William had left a short will. It was a very short will. In those days, wills covered pages, but this was just a paragraph. It was a soldier's will, and it left everything to Bess. The younger brother contested the will in court. Bess went to court, fought her corner.
And again, Bess won her case.
Here was Bess now at the age of 38, and she was a rich woman because she had Chatsworth. She had the huge West Country estates of the St. Lowe family.
An independent woman by this point, Bess's annual income was said to be around £60,000, the equivalent to well over £10 million a year today. And that made her one of the richest people in the country, well ahead of most of the nobility in Elizabethan England, for whom the average income was between £15,000 and £25,000.
She, in theory, does not need to marry again. But I suppose what she didn't have, and what was really important within Elizabethan society, was that status that came with a title. And this is what Bess achieved through her fourth marriage.
Along came a real catch. This was the Earl of Shrewsbury. The Earl fell madly in love with Bess. Actually, this marriage made Bess one of the highest ranking women at court.
The Earl's name was George Talbot, and they married in 1567, and Bess became a countess, a title which ranks just below a duchess.
He's from a very old, well-established family. A lot of his wealth and property was centred in the Midlands, like Bess's was, in Derbyshire, South Yorkshire, Nottinghamshire. So they had much in common, really.
It was a happy marriage for 4 or 5 years. They just had a wonderful time. They flicked between Sheffield Castle and Chatsworth.
After her marriage, Bess embarked on decorating the staterooms at Chatsworth to befit her new status as a countess. And in Elizabethan England, the most expensive art form anyone could commission to decorate their home was embroidery.
We refer to the embroideries as the noble women embroideries, and we believe Bess and perhaps George Talbot together commissioned them in the 1570s. They contain 5 pieces depicting women from mythology, so either queens in their own right or important noble women from classical mythology.
Each embroidered hanging was carefully and meticulously sewn in velvet, gold thread and patterned silk by skilled embroiderers. They took several years to make.
Each noble woman is depicted in the centre of the hanging with arches over them. And then the virtues that they personify, their figures are stood either side of them, slightly smaller figures, less dominating. The hangings themselves are large. They're about 6 to 7 feet high. So big panels. that would have really dominated the room and really made a statement.
But more than just being a statement of wealth and status, the five women Bess chose all seemed to be an expression of her own personality.
If you look at the faces of these women, it looks like the portraits of Bess, as if someone has taken the image onto the tapestry in their needlepoint and they've actually copied Bess's portrait.
There's Lucretia, noblewoman of ancient Rome.
It's quite a tragic story. She is raped by Sextus, who is son of the Roman king, and he threatens to dishonour her and her family if she says anything. But what she does, she quickly admits to the rape and then she commits suicide. Lucretia's actually depicted as stabbing herself in the heart. Lucretia is personified by chastity and liberality. Liberality is that loyalty to your family, themes that Bess really related to. Another of the hangings is Zenobia, and she was a warrior queen, and she's depicted as such in her armour and with her weapons. So Zenobia is famous for carrying on her husband's campaign after he died, so carrying on his cause.
The next hanging is of the Greek warrior queen, Artemisia, who built one of the seven wonders of the world, the mausoleum at Halicarnassus, for her dead husband.
It's said that Artemisia really pined away for her husband. She was grief-stricken, and she expressed her grief in a number of ways. So she created his tomb, but also she's said to have provided a living tomb for his ashes. She put them in a glass of wine and drank them as well. She is personified in the hanging with constancy and piety, which are very apt.
And then we have Cleopatra.
Unfortunately, we've only got a fragment of the lower part of the hanging, so we don't know what Cleopatra would have looked like, but she was famous for her love affairs with Mark Antony and Julius Caesar. And educated Elizabethans would have seen Cleopatra as a great queen, just like they had a great queen at the time.
The final hanging is the most striking. It features Penelope, the wife of the mythical Greek hero Ulysses, whose 10-year-long journey home from the Trojan War was immortalised by Homer in his epic poem, The Odyssey. We'll come back to her a little later. Bess's visitors to Chatsworth must have been astounded by these huge, colourful hangings. It would have seemed that she was a woman who had it all, wealth, land, status, and a loving husband. But in reality, the Shrewsbury's marriage was unravelling at the seams.
Along came what really was Bess's nemesis, and that was Mary, Queen of Scots.
The Earl and his wife had been entrusted by Elizabeth I to look after Mary after she had fled Scotland. But the expense and the emotional strain of putting up such an illustrious houseguest took a toll on their marriage.
The Queen found it very difficult to make a decision about what to do. So as faithful subjects, they helped the Queen to look after Mary. Probably the summer, she was thinking, but 15 years later, George and Bess were still looking after Mary, Queen of Scots.
I often think how difficult it must have been for Bess, because after all, she's in her 40s now, and she wasn't ugly, but she was fairly plain. But Mary, Queen of Scots, was a real beauty, and she had to watch this woman flirting with her husband.
And there were even rumours that the 26-year-old Queen might have manipulated Bess's husband into having an affair with her.
It put a huge strain on the relationship and their finances as well, because Mary and her royal retinue had to be looked after.
Mary developed a strategy of, against her custodians really, of divide and rule. And eventually she came between the couple. She broke that marriage up.
The relationship had got very bad. She was being threatened by George Talbot's retainers. It got very bitter, unfortunately. So much so that the Queen herself waded in, but that didn't help resolve their differences.
And it's clear from the letters they sent to each other at the time that those differences ran deep.
Your letter of the third of this instant, carrying so fair and unaccustomed show of dutifulness and humility of spirit, cometh now so late and so out of season that makes me suspect it to be a siren song set for some other purpose than it pretendeth.
My lord, the innocence of my own heart is such, and my desire so infinite to procure your good conceit, as I will leave no ways unsought to attain your favour, which long you have restrained from me. I know, my lord, that hatred must grow of something, and how I have deserved your indignation is invisible to me.
It was Chatsworth that they were fighting about principally, who owned it, who had that interest in it. There was an inquest and an investigation into the marriage and whether Bess had behaved appropriately.
That investigation took the form of a royal commission, presided over by Lord Chancellor Bromley and two chief justices, which found decisively in Bess's favour. Yet again, she'd taken on the male establishment and won.
Eventually, they separated and Bess moved back to Chatsworth. Chatsworth was entailed to her eldest son, Henry, and she wanted something of her own, so she went back to Hardwick, which was her birthplace.
And so, with this messy separation behind her, Bess set about rebuilding her family home.
I'm standing in the West Court at Hardwick Hall, looking out over the garden walls towards the old hall, which is now in a ruined state, which is in stark contrast to the magnificent Hardwick New Hall that I'm now facing. Bess of Hardwick started this project in 1590 and was then able to move in 1597. The hall itself is built using what we call Hardwick stone, and it's a yellow sandstone which absorbs all the sunlight and looks magnificent on a day like today. What really strikes you, however, is the use of glass. It's everywhere. Today, Hardwick looks like a lantern on top of a hill.
As the local saying goes, Hardwick Hall, more glass than wall. Bess's extravagant use of what was an expensive and rare material in 16th century England was just one more way of parading her massive wealth.
As we work our way up the hall, we come to the tracery at the top. And Hardwick is famous for the ES that sits at the top of the six turrets. And the coronet, of course, because Bess herself was a countess. And the ES relate to Elizabeth, Countess of Shrewsbury. The hall itself is a massive statement of how far she had come in her time and is a testament to her wealth, her power and her status. What we're going to do now is walk along the stone path from the gatehouse up to the hall. On either side of me are the lawns and then the flower beds, which are slowly coming back to life on this spring day. We're just approaching the colonnade and we'll go up to the steps and then head in through the entrance door. We're now in the entrance hall, which is cool and dark. I'm heading right towards the butler's pantry. And this is where we showcase the Penelope hanging.
Of all the noble women hangings, the Penelope hanging is the most intriguing and most closely linked to Bess.
I am standing in front of the Penelope hanging, one of the finest Elizabethan textiles in the country. Penelope stands in the centre. She is shown wearing a crown. She ruled Ithaca in Ulysses' absence while he was away fighting in the Trojan War. One of her hands is raised in warning. She had spent about 10 years fending off suitors while she faithfully waited for her husband to return. Perseverance and patience stand on either side of her. These smaller figures represent the virtues that Penelope personified whilst waiting for her husband. Bess really identified with that, and through her lifetime had showed herself to be those things. So perseverance stands to Penelope's right, holding an eagle which seems to be flying towards the sun. Patience stands on Penelope's left with her arms folded and a long-tailed sheep reaching up to her.
And next to these personifications are medallions. The first with the coat of arms of Bess and her fourth husband, the Earl of Shrewsbury. The other medallion has the Talbot hound on it, Bess's family symbol. Bess has literally embroidered herself, her symbol, into Penelope's story.
Penelope was a strong woman and a faithful wife. Themes that Bess could relate to and wanted to demonstrate and perhaps was demonstrating through this hanging.
Bess died in her 80s, which was a very old age in those days. She died in 1608, 5 years after Queen Elizabeth. And right to the end, she was running her businesses like a modern-day magnate. She had a sort of native intelligence, you know, that she picked up. She sort of self-educated herself as she went along. There wasn't anyone else like her. We don't know very much about most women in Tudor times. We know a lot about the women who were in the royal circles. We know very little about ordinary people. Bess is one of the few people that we do know anything about, and it is because she was an extraordinary woman.
Bess of Hardwick was indeed extraordinary. Like Penelope, she was determined, steadfast, loyal, and cunning. In a male-dominated world, she overcame a succession of difficulties and emerged as the second richest person in England. And it's thanks to her we have the opportunity to marvel at the Penelope hanging at Hardwick Hall over 400 years later. Thanks for listening to this final episode of the 125 Treasures mini-series. Remember, the Noble Women embroideries are just one of many treasures featured in 125 Treasures from the collections of the National Trust, a brand new book of stunning photography and descriptions of the most exciting decorative arts, furniture, books and textiles in our collection, spanning the Roman era to the present day. To learn more about this publication, go to nationaltrust.org.uk/125pod-women or follow the link in the show notes. If you've enjoyed this series, you may enjoy other audio programmes from the National Trust Podcast Network. To learn more, go to nationaltrust.org.uk/podcasts. I'm Alison Steadman, and this is 125 Treasures, a podcast from the National Trust.